18 years, from 1969 to 84.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really a neat time, I thought, because you had really good leaders, people that were successful in their community and they were successful there.
Yeah.
You know, Vic Atiyah, Lynn Newbery, Stafford Hansel, really guys that were always interested in doing what was best for the state. There was politics involved, but it was a positive thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'll never forget the first time I went into a Ways and Means Committee hearing. You know, I was new on the job, and so I studied, you know, 24/7, kind of
right.
thinking I needed to know more than anybody in the room, which I may have done at the time.
Uh-huh.
But after about three or four questions, it was remarkable the benefit of that diversified thinking.
Yeah.
It honed legislation and ideas and concept and made them better.
Yeah.
And what I perceive today, I haven't been engaged in the legislature for years, but it's a far different thing today. It's us versus them kind of thing, and we can never compromise. And so you lose that heroic benefit of diversified thinking at a time where our problems are much bigger than they were then.
Yeah.
Do you see that, or is that just...
Yeah, no, I definitely see that, and virtually everybody I talk to says the same thing.
Is that right?
Okay. A week ago, I was talking with Earl Blumenauer.
Yeah.
Because Earl is the only person who served with Vic in the legislature who's still...
Active
in government.
Mm, I'll be doing
it. You know, the Peter Courtney's came on when Vic was governor.
Right, right.
You know, Earl said the same thing. You know, it was a wet behind the ears 23, 25-year-old.
Yep. Oh, I remember.
He was sitting there, and Staff Hansel's cubicle was next to his office. And, you know, so he said, you know, I had a successful insurance executive, a successful doctor, and then the most innovative farmer I've ever met.
Yes, exactly.
And then they were engaged at a very high level in how do we solve these problems.
Right, right.
And you don't see that anymore.
Yeah, that's too bad.
Yeah.
That's too bad.
Part of it appears to be the partisanship, but the partisanship's been also reinforced single-member districts that switch after 1970 have played a real interesting role.
Yeah.
And then the rise of the environmental movement, the public employee unions and the business community funding one party or the other.
Yeah.
Ted Kulongoski was saying, and even in 82, he and Vic were going after exactly the same money. Because those things hadn't split like that at that point.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, money has been, it becomes such a major part of that. It has widened the divide.
Yeah.
If I'm a Koch brother and I'm going to give you $1 million, I want you to do this.
Yeah.
You can't do that.
Yeah.
And if on the other side, it's the same kind of thing. If I'm a union going to do this, you can't do that.
Yeah.
And so they're captives almost by contract.
Right, right. And we're seeing that in the current legislature where the low carbon fuels.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of stuff. The Oregonian editorial page is just hilarious to watch. They're being too partisans, like, you know, they ran on that, the money was for that. What did you expect them to do?
Yeah, exactly.
They gained seats.
Right.
This is not a mystery.
Right, right. And then at the national level, you got Doug Grover Norquist that held most of the people that have signed that contract, they can't raise
it. Yeah.
I mean, they're
through. So and it's not only taxes, it's that you won't raise fees.
Anything.
I mean,
my daughter works back there, and she was telling me about a guy, I can't remember his name, but he was a conservative, very conservative senator from Oklahoma that cut a budget and took the money and invested it in something that he wanted to do or that the committee wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And he was excoriated because that was interpreted to be raising taxes.
Yeah.
Once you cut, you can't reinvest.
Yeah.
I mean, God.
Yeah. it's stunning. It's stunning. And then there's Vic, you know, who, among other things, is saying we do need to have a temporary income tax surcharge.
Yeah.
And by the end of his seventh year, he says, you know, I've opposed the downward sales tax all the time. But, yeah, we have to have an income or a sales tax proposal.
Yeah, right.
And,
right.
you know, it gets shot down totally. But
oh, yeah. It's that's become an Oregon thing.
Oh, yeah.
Seems like, so.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, how can I help you?
Well, so you were legislative administration.
No, I was the legislative fiscal office.
Legislative fiscal office, okay. Mm-hmm. So Vic is, during most of that time, he's minority leader in the Senate. Mm-hmm. Of an ever-decreasing number of Republican
senators. Right, right, right.
And then he becomes governor. So did you work with him in that capacity?
I worked with him, and this is a... He never was on the Ways and Means Committee.
Right.
When I was there, anyway. Right. And when did he start? In 59?
59, yeah.
Because I remember that he had about 20 years' experience in the governorship, which was a real, real positive. The legislature there used to be a legislative fiscal office.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there still is a legislative fiscal office, but there was a legislative fiscal committee that since went away when they expanded the emergency board. It used to be a 9-member emergency board. And what the legislative fiscal committee did was that they went into detail on those issues that were discovered during the session, the 6-month session, by the Ways and Means Committee or other committees, that they wanted to ferret out a little bit more. For example, you might see the Fish and Wildlife Commission. They had an issue about housing. Okay, well, let's take a look at that and really see if that's necessary. Things like that. And when I first worked with Vic, I think it was in 69 or maybe 71, he was on the Legislative Fiscal Committee. And he was a bright guy. And I remember distinctly the issue was, used to be kind of a culture in state government that you retain all the state lands. Now, not the state lands that the Division of State Lands has, but I'm talking about the prisons and the Department of General Services that had isolated tracts.
Right.
It was scattered all over hell.
Yeah.
And nobody, there was never a clear policy as to what the hell you ought to do with that stuff. Well, Vic sorted all that out. He was in chair of the subcommittee that had that assignment, and basically said, look, there's no reason to hold on to this stuff. Let's put it into productive use, unless there is a good reason. If you want it for a park or for a transportation or something like that, or maybe an office building, go ahead and retain it. Otherwise, get rid of it. And it was one of those aha moments. I mean, it sounds silly now, but it was that kind of stuff. That's the first time I ran into it. Work with him there. And that was, I think it was in 69, maybe, I think it was a 71 interim, I'm not sure. And then he was always interactive with the staff. Back then, you didn't have the staffing to the degree you have now.
Right.
There was only two permanent staffs. It was legislative council and legislative fiscal. They didn't have legislative administration, all these other things. And so we, during the interim particularly, we would field all kinds of questions, and he was always pretty curious. So I got to know him.
Yeah. The kind of his business mind adapting to government is just fascinating to watch.
Right.
He's elected in 58 and 59. He's on the, I think he's on the revenue committee, but he takes homework home. Here are assumptions in a bill on fiscal stuff, and so we have his legal pad, where he's done the math, and then writes up and says, it isn't what you guys think it is.
Right.
Because he went home and did his homework.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's just...
The other guy that did that was Stafford Hansel. He knew more than... I mean, he would be the first guy to get the copy of the governor's budget. And he'd take it home and study it, and he'd be asking us about it. Vic did a lot of the same kind of thing. They were both very bright people, but they wanted to know so that they could make fact-based decisions
rather than
political ones.
Yeah.
They had their values, clearly.
Yeah.
But he was an interesting guy.
Yeah. Did any of that, your work with him, shift when he became minority leader in 71?
No, I didn't work that closely with him.
Okay.
When I really worked pretty closely with him was started in 84.
Okay.
When I got recruited to go over to the Department of Human Resources. And I was a deputy over there, and Leo Hegstrom was a director. And we got to work hand in hand with the governor. He really was an executive.
Yeah.
He was probably the last true executive in that office.
Yeah. Yeah, talking both to Barbara Roberts and Ted Kulongoski. You know, because Barbara Roberts was Secretary of State, becomes Secretary of State, 84 election.
Right, exactly.
So she got to sit in on the meetings, the weekly meetings and things like that. And they both said, you know, we all try to do what Vic did.
Yeah.
And the pressures of time and things like that make it so hard now. So I don't know if it's a personality thing. Well,
there's another thing. I think there's another complicating factor in that. Vic, with 20 years experience.
Mm-hmm.
You get to see the executive branch and objectively and in detail like you can't in any other way, because you see the leadership come over there under pressure, you know, before a committee. It's a pressure cooker.
Yeah.
And it shows your strengths and weaknesses pretty quickly.
Yeah.
Because when I went over to the executive department, I had had that benefit, and I knew who were all the managers were.
Mm-hmm.
Had a real advantage, and I'm sure he had even more so because he had more experience, and he knew who the leaders were, and he appointed very good executives to direct organizations that he knew personally and he had confidence in. Then he would express what his boundaries were, like a true executive, but he never got in your way. You knew where he was. He was very clear on that. Now, the reason I say he was the last one is that in 87, when Goldsmith succeeded him, Neil was, he didn't have that benefit. He came he was sort of an outsider. I mean, he had some insight as a consequence of his mayoral experience and the interaction, but he didn't have that same knowledge of state government. And as a consequence, Neil brought in a whole cadre of policy advisors, if you remember that. He was the first governor to do that. And I'm not criticizing him. Maybe from where he sat, that was a good thing to do. But that has become a permanent fixture. And it's actually expanded dramatically from where he started. And so with Barbara, there was a filter in between those. And it gets pretty blurry. And you can't execute quite as clearly and crisply as you can when you're the direct contact to the key guy running the agency.
Right.
He eliminated all those fillers.
Right.
So he had that advantage as well.
Vic was actually pretty ticked off at what Neil did. So, but with Barbara, even she's quite upfront about the fact that eventually her staff was running things and not even keeping her in the loop.
I worked for her. I was the, that was a very long 2-year period. When she came in, it was right on the heels of ballot measure 5.
Right.
And so there was a lot of stuff that had to be done. And so one of the things that I was the director of the Department of General Services, and so I recommended, you know, at that stage, let's merge those two things and get rid of some overhead. And then I became the first director of the Department of General Services under Barbara. And you're absolutely right, and so is she. Patricia McCaig was very, very forceful, you know this, from her experience. And for better or for worse, I mean, she was very, very aggressive, particularly with agency directors. And Barbara, I think, lost that that connection, and I think it hurt.
Yeah,
when it did. And that's interesting that she said that.
Yeah,
I never have talked to her about it, but that doesn't surprise me at all.
Yeah. So when Vic is governor, are you going to those regular weekly meetings?
Absolutely. Yeah.
So what took place during them? Were they truly substantive? Is it? I mean, I've seen the schedule.
Well, there were two parts to that.
Mm-hmm.
The weekly staff meetings, it was around the table.
Mm-hmm.
What are the key issues?
Mm-hmm.
And then if there was a key issue, he'd key in on that a little bit. Mm-hmm. But if it was really a significant issue, then you had follow-up meetings directly one-on-one with the governor.
Mm-hmm.
Give you an example. You may recall there was a fellow out of the Oregon State Prison. Forever. God, I'm trying to think
Yeah.
He's an icon. I mean, he's been there forever, but he was corrupt.
Yeah.
And that came out.
Mm-hmm.
And so we spent quite a bit of time directly talking with Vic
mm-hmm.
about that.
Mm-hmm.
And it was interesting how he handled it. I mean, he said, just do the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't get in your way
mm-hmm.
because he knew that we were going to do the right thing and
right.
we would deal with it. Yeah. He had that confidence in us rather than having a whole bunch of people,
mm-hmm.
you know, swarming around. And we did.
Mm-hmm.
But we followed up on that as well. The other thing I remember clearly was it was during the session. Oregon hadn't built a prison for forever,
mm-hmm.
and they had prison overcrowding. We were stacking people on top mm-hmm. of each other. When I was in the General Services, corrections reported to the Department of Transfer, the Director of Human Resources. We had employment, corrections, all of those. It was a big
trial.
And so we were suffering from overcrowding, and then during the session, they came up with a proposal to change the Eastern Oregon Mental Institution into a prison.
Mm-hmm.
So we worked with the local leaders and all that other stuff, and actually developed a pretty good package. Then it came time to implement that, and I was over there at the Department of
mm-hmm.
Human Resources, and I grew up in Pendleton, so they said, okay, you go handle this.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the thing had passed the legislature by a vote or two. It was pretty
mm-hmm.
controversial at the time, and the deal had been made in terms of what we were going to do for the community and what they were going to do, et cetera, et cetera. Then you got to dealing with the local politicians. It was like dealing with the worst car dealer you've ever imagined.
Yeah.
And so I told Vic, I said, you're going to have to arbitrate this, because I said, I can hold them, but they ain't going to,
mm-hmm.
they're going to, unless you tell them. He says, bring them in.
Yeah.
And he did. He says, no.
mm-hmm.
We'll do this, but we won't do that.
That's great.
Yeah, but it was that kind of involvement.
Yeah.
And he knew. He just knew because he was, well, first of all, we kept him abreast.
Mm-hmm.
He was always accessible.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, he was just really a neat guy.
Mm-hmm. That's fun. Next week I'm going to be going out to Mike and Jill Thorne's ranch.
Yeah, well,
which
Mike
is basically go there, turn
yeah,
left
right,
at the
right.
at the
yeah.
at the ring.
I went through school with Mike.
Yeah,
he's a good guy. You'll
yeah.
like talking to him.
Yeah.
Well, he was engaged in that as well.
Yeah, had he come over to the executive at that point?
Had I?
No, Mike.
No, he was still in the legislature.
Still in the legislature. So
he went from. I think didn't he go to the Port of Portland?
Yeah.
I think
that's the direct thing. It's just
he
was so involved, whatever committee he had was so involved in the lottery that I kind of mix him up.
Mm.
When the lottery was implemented, there was a lot of negotiating with Mike to make sure that the lottery money went to economic development.
Certain stuff, yeah. That's true. That's true. He was on Ways and Means.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he was good.
Yeah.
Yeah, I grew up playing baseball with him.
Uh-huh.
Went to grade school with him.
That's great. That's great.
So, anyway.
So, you're there from 69 in the legislature's legislative side, 69 to 84. Or, 69 to 84. Talk about the differences in management style that you saw with McCall to Straub.
Okay.
You talk about that there's a change when you get to Goldstone.
As I say, I started in 69, and I had not extensive, but
mm-hmm.
enough interaction with McCall and his staff to
mm-hmm.
kind of draw some conclusions or
mm-hmm.
forms of opinions,
mm-hmm.
and that is that the way I would describe McCall is that he was a extraordinarily good judge of people,
mm-hmm.
and he had really good people around him.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like Vic. He was curious. He'd go to, I mean, hell, I was just a legislative analyst, and you'd be in a meeting, and he'd always ask you what you thought.
Mm-hmm.
Because he knew the value of, again, diversified thinking.
Yeah.
He'd get in a room, and and you go around and he'd ask everybody, and pretty soon you had a pretty good idea of what ought to be done.
Mm-hmm.
He was masterful at that. I can't speak to how he was with his staff,
mm-hmm. That's fine.
but what he did, and you know all this anyway, but one of his initiatives was to kind of restructure government, to put them into kind of logical groupings.
Mm-hmm.
There's a bunch of boards and stuff. He'd put them into a group of people like transportation. He didn't create the Department of Transportation, but he created a kind of an office,
mm-hmm.
that kind of oversaw that stuff, was a pretty good idea. The Department of Human Resources, he,
mm-hmm.
put that together.
Mm-hmm.
So he, I'm sure that he was really a pretty good executive, or he had confidence in the person that he had hired,
right,
to help him put that together.
Yeah,
and there weren't any layers in between governors then.
Mm-hmm.
Hell, the Department of Economic Development was one guy.
Yeah.
And it worked pretty good,
mm-hmm.
in my view.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I'd say about him. As I say, I was just a kid and I didn't have all that much interaction with him.
Yeah.
Straub was, I liked Straub a lot. He was really a decent guy,
mm-hmm.
solid values. But I don't think he had the abilities that McCall or Atiyah did in terms of judging people, because,
mm-hmm.
his nemesis was his staff.
Mm-hmm.
And you know that. I'm not,
mm-hmm.
naming the name, but I could.
Mm-hmm.
And that was what sunk him, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for an incumbent Democrat in Oregon to lose the second election, you gotta
the last time an incumbent has lost.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, as an executive, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he would make mistakes and he wouldn't correct them. A good executive does that.
Right.
He didn't do that.
Right.
So, but I don't really.
Yeah.
Really, wasn't that close to
the
administration.
You know, because Vic loses that election in '74, and it's funny talking to Vic and the people around him. They just came out of that actually thrilled.
Yeah.
And they lost by the biggest number that had since 1950. They got creamed.
Exactly.
But that's not how they saw it. They,
mm-hmm.
saw it as a real, wow, this is a real interesting thing.
Right.
And Vic, I can't remember the exact thing, but there was some Straub appointment, maybe even as chief of staff. There's a Straub appointment and then a tax thing right at the beginning of Straub's time. And Vic,
yeah.
looked out there and said, ooh, there's two mistakes right there.
Yeah, I think that's right.
And
the chief of staff is who I was referring to.
Yeah.
As I say, he's a nice guy, bless his soul. He's,
yeah.
gone now, but he was not the guy for the job.
Yeah, yeah.
At all.
Absolutely,
yeah.
Absolutely. Did you interact a lot with Atiyah's staff? I mean, after you came over, were you,
oh, yeah.
playing around with Jerry and?
Right.
So what was his?
He didn't have a lot of staff.
Mm-hmm.
He really didn't.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't have to go through anybody to get to him.
Yeah.
That was a huge benefit. And just for context, when you were talking about Straub and that interim, Vic was also the perfect guy for the job in 1979.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you remember the numbers, but I can vaguely recall them. That is that from 1971-73, the state general fund budget was about $750 million.
Mm-hmm.
In 1977-79, it was $3.2 billion.
Yeah.
And what was going on, and I'm sure you know all this stuff, is that inflation and an income,
mm-hmm.
tax, you had revenues,
mm-hmm.
timber companies were harvesting a lot of their timber on private lands to invest in southern pine forests, et cetera, et cetera. So there were a bunch of things driving that, and it was the legislature had so much money they had to kind of create ways to make sure that it doesn't backfire when you had the inevitable,
right.
downfall.
Yeah,
they had property tax relief programs.
Yeah,
they took the state police and park out of the highway fund, which I think was a heroic mistake. We argued against that, but then the big collapse. So who should you turn to?
Mm-hmm.
He was perfect for that job. think anybody else could have done it that I knew of at the time that had the knowledge and the background and perspective and the strength of character to do what you had to do, notwithstanding the party line. And like you said, you know, you put in a temporary tax, which you had to do if you're going to maintain any semblance of state government. So he was ideal for the job.
Yeah, it's fascinating. You know, when I started sabbatical at the end of January, and because I do a bunch of media stuff, then I missed 2 weeks of working on the book because our governor was blowing up. In fact, I was interviewing Jerry on the crucial Thursday. So I interviewed her, then I had lunch with a former student, just a couple blocks from the Capitol, all the while checking, is anything happening? Then I went up and went to a funeral at Lake Oswego. When I got home, my voicemail had exploded. It was just like, whoa, there we go. But you know, just thinking, what if all that had happened 3 years or 4 years earlier when the recession was hard here? You know, I think Kate will do just fine. I don't know if she'll be spectacular, but I think she'll do just fine. But you need that experience to deal with that stuff.
You do. Yeah, and as I say, I don't know anybody else that could have done that.
Yeah.
I'm sure there were, but I don't know who they were.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because I haven't figured out the answer to this, but, I mean, Vic always, no matter what he was running for, he didn't declare until late. Frustrated his staff to no end. Because he was always, and it was one of his principles, don't govern for your next election, govern to do what you think is right.
Right.
But there's always a very real chance that he would not run again. Who would have been the Republican nominee in 82? There's no hint of anybody else really coming in. The Democrats were having, you know, eventually it's Betty Roberts and Jim Redden, no, that's 78. But in any case, there's stuff there. Jim Weaver's name comes up, you know, all sorts of things in 82, but there's nothing on the Republican side.
Well, so it could have been, you know, a guy like Stafford, maybe, but he didn't have the base.
No.
I mean, he was really good at that, but he didn't have the statewide
thing. The only thing I could think of it'd be, you know, possibly a Hatfield or a Packwood coming back, but you know, by that point, they were well in Wisconsin, D.C.
Yeah, exactly right. Well, what you say is, you know, he really did live the adage of good policy makes good politics. I think he was right. He proved it over and over again. That's all changed, but he was really good. And then the other thing that he did. The transition when Neil came in, he left him with a full tank of gas. He really did. I mean, and I don't know if he did that consciously or what, but when he left, I probably was conscious. I mean, that was probably one of his principles, was to leave it in order.
Yeah.
And he gave Neil a great launching pad.
Yeah.
It was really, really something to see. Neil was an interesting governor, too. Notwithstanding all of the controversy, he was a brilliant guy. He wasn't an executive, but a brilliant guy.
Did you see, what was the dynamic? You talked about McCall and Atiyah as having great staff to go with them. What was the balance that you saw with Goldschmidt?
Well, he appointed me to the Department of General Services. He's a really fun guy to work for. And I didn't have a policy by it, per se, because it was, he told me basically to make the agency work or close it. It's your choice. And so I had a pretty clear directive. And so I got along really well, and I liked him a lot and got a lot of things done. In terms of accomplishment, when you know this from his workers' compensation reform, I don't think anybody else could pull that off.
Yeah.
That was an amazing thing.
Yeah.
Vic might have been able to, but it was the time wasn't quite right.
No, and for 7 years he's basically dealing with the economy.
Right.
So yeah.
But the interaction with the staff was, well, when I was at General Service or at Human Resource, I was throughout that session, the first session when he came in. I was a director, and I had a policy advisor, and other policy advisors were involved. And I can give you an example about a woman who was, I liked her a lot. She was a young, sharp person. And they asked me what I thought about appointing her to be the director of the Department of Public Welfare. And I said, big mistake. I said, that's the toughest job in state government. You know, you got Medicaid, and boy, if you, I mean, it's very complex and it's demanding. You got all the pharmacists, doctors, all that stuff to deal with, plus all the vagaries of public assistance. It's a tough job in state government. Don't do that, it'll destroy her. And it did. They went ahead and did it anyway. So they didn't, and that was secondhand. If I had have talked to Neil, it might have been a different outcome, I don't know. But that was that filtering thing that I'm talking about. And that kind of soured me on that whole policy advisor thing.
Yeah.
I didn't like it, still don't.
How easy was it to get access to Neil?
Pretty easy. If I needed to talk to him, I could.
Okay.
Yeah, Fred Miller was the kind of his executive staff, and I could deal with him. But I could get in, and I did on many occasions. I got to talk to him because we were involved in some fairly controversial things on the Capitol Mall construction and all that stuff, and then that Portland building blew up because of that Eastern Oregon judge. But he was accessible.
Yeah,
he was, and then he was really accessible. I remember on workers' compensation, he came over to my department, just kind of for a walk through, and he says, I'm going to make a run to reform workers' compensation. And when I do, I want to make damn sure that the state of Oregon's house is in order. I don't want to be accused of not paying attention to my own stuff. And at the time, at General Services, which still does, we were kind of the risk manager for workers' compensation. And so at the time, state managers really didn't understand workers' comp very well. I mean, we looked, check the math now and then, and that was about it. So dove into that and made damn sure our house was in order. But it was that kind of stuff. He was good at that.
Yeah.
He was very good at explaining what he wanted to do and making it clear. But that was too bad.
Yeah.
That was too bad. He was a world-class politician.
You know, he's been described, I think, by people who hate him and people who love him. Well, actually, not that many people love him, but the people who respect him. He's just a bright, bright guy.
Oh, yeah.
Even with a bright staff, he was like three or four steps ahead of them all the time.
Right.
So
he was. And sometimes, and people would observe this, you'd get in a meeting with him, and he'd go off on a rift. I mean, it was just brilliant. And then you won't leave the room. They say, okay, now what the hell am I supposed to do?
Right. What's implementable about that?
To say you're one of the few people that will ever ask him a question. Because, I don't know, it was my background or training or something. But I'd say, okay, well, but what about this? What about this? Yeah. I got along really well with him.
Yeah.
I liked him a lot.
Yeah.
More fun. I had more fun in that job than anything I've ever done, I think.
That's great. Were you there... how long did you stay in Seco? Were you
there? I retired in 95.
95, so Kitzhaber was just started.
Yeah, but I knew Kitzhaber pretty well from the days in the Senate.
Yeah.
And Kulongoski as well.
Yeah.
Worked really closely with both of them.
Yeah. In looking at the 82 election, I just found a great column from the Register Guard. If Kulongoski did not get in, and it wasn't certain that he was going to get in, he didn't declare until like February or something. They were talking about Kitzhaber,
really?
Like age 34, but this rabble rouser who clearly was a bright up and comer.
Yeah,
and they were talking about, you know, maybe this Kitzhaber guy will get in. It's like, jeez Louise.
Interesting. What's going on with Kitzhaber these days? I mean, he's just dropped off the face.
Off the face of the earth. At the end of May, he was spotted in a coffee house in Northwest Portland. Someone took a picture. Yeah, I gotta shake my journalist connections because I'd love to talk to him for the book. During the time that you're in the executive, he and Vera, Kits and Cats, are the key players there.
Yeah.
And Vera's not, I mean, she's kind of beyond that at this point. I'd love to be able to talk to Kit Sauber, and love to be able to talk to Goldschmidt.
What's wrong with Vera?
Because she had cancer,
yeah.
And so she's at the stage now where it's not quite dementia, but she's just really,
really
kind of losing touch with reality.
I know, that's too bad.
I happened to be meeting some of my departmental colleagues in downtown Portland, and there she was sitting outside, and you would barely recognize her.
Well, she was cloistered about 10, 12 years ago.
Yeah.
When she left the mayor's office.
When she left the mayor's office, because her first cancer bout was when she was mayor.
Yeah.
Then she kind of came out of it, and then...
Because I knew her staff, and I got her number a ton, and I left her a ton of messages. I just wanted to go up and have lunch with her and thank her for all the good things that she did. I was a real fan of hers. I watched her develop from someone that was hardly find the bathroom to someone that was really very adept in the legislature. And then what she did in the city of Portland, I think, remarkable.
Yeah.
After, you know, I lived for a while in the East and got to see, you know, what influenced that, and but I never could. I never could get a return phone call even.
Yeah.
So that's too bad. That's too bad. She's a special lady.
Yeah. So I think at some point this summer I will just go, because I know where she hangs out, just go see if she's there. Norma Paulus is in the same situation. Sometimes she's really good.
I see Norma quite a bit. Roger Martin has this old-timers club.
I'll be there on Friday.
Well, I won't. Friday's my birthday.
Oh, okay.
Maybe that's where I've seen you.
No, I haven't been there.
Oh, you haven't been there?
No.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, Friday is my birthday, so I'm going to go. I play golf.
Mm-hmm.
So my son lives in Seattle, and I'm taking my son and grandson to Chambers Bay, the U.S. Open.
Oh, great, great. So fantastic.
Good to see that.
Yeah.
That's where I see Norma.
Norma, yeah.
Now, when you talk to her, that's not very apparent. I know that from reports and others, but it's not very apparent.
Yeah. Roger said the last old-timers gathering that she told a good joke.
Yeah.
You know, she seemed to be really with it.
Smart.
Yeah.
I mean, I talked to her either the last time or the time before. She was talking about reading the New Yorker in Burns, Oregon. And I said, I used to read that in Pendleton, Oregon. I said, we were probably the only two people that saw that magazine east of the Cascades.
Exactly.
And we had a good laugh about the stuff.
Yeah.
She told me all kinds of stories. She'd save all the covers and papered her bathroom and all this stuff.
That's right.
I mean, I thought,
yeah,
she's pretty,
yeah,
she handles it well.
Yeah.
She handles it very well.
Yeah. Yeah, I've talked to her daughter-in-law. You know, sometimes she's there and sometimes she just isn't.
So. Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. What else?
Let's see here. Let's go back to the staff. So are you primarily dealing with Jerry? Or
good question. If Vic was on a tour or out, you know, talking to the customer base, it was Jerry. But if he was there, it was... Yeah,
it was straight to Vic.
Yeah, he was.
Okay.
Well, it wasn't straight to Vic. Jerry was typically there.
Yeah.
But he didn't. If it was a, and we didn't bug him with the
right.
I mean, it would be a big deal.
Yeah.
And he was there.
Yeah.
That's my memory.
Okay.
But it was really good because you got one or the other always. Mm-hmm. And they always were clear on what the boundaries were.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he told you what to expect. He gave you feedback, and he gave you the tools to do the job, and he stayed out of your way.
Mm-hmm.
That's the quintessence of a good executive.
Yeah.
He was really good.
Yeah.
He was really good.
It's funny because at some point, it's in his second term, I think, but at some point, he decides he's not going back to the carpet business.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason was very simple. He liked making decisions by himself. he just wasn't going to go back to this three-way thing.
What was this? He had a great line about one day your...
you're one of the peacock, the next thing you're the feather duster. The
feather duster.
Yeah.
That was a great line.
He has a whole bunch of those. In fact, the day that he told me that he wanted me to write his book, he was showing us his fishing licenses. Because when you're the governor, your fishing license 0001 or whatever.
Really?
And then in 1987, your fishing license 3,272. Like, well, there you go.
Yeah, exactly. Interesting. Fish and wildlife. A lot of stories there, too. I can tell you, but I won't.
Were you involved, did the Rajishis wash up at all in anything that you were doing?
Peripherally, yeah. I mean, just like you. I mean, I read about it. Mm-hmm. I knew a friend of mine, Stan Long and Frohnmeyer, were engaged in that.
Yeah.
And I know about it because I've got, you know,
yeah.
I know Stan pretty well. Got some the explanation, but I wasn't engaged in that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay.
It was a subject that I
yeah.
was involved.
Yeah, the week when I had planned on Thursday to call Dave Frohnmeyer mm-hmm. is the week that he died on
yeah.
Tuesday.
Were you as surprised as I was?
Oh, yeah. That? Yeah. In fact, a year and a half ago, Vic, there was an abortive attempt at a biography of him about 10 years ago. And the person who was doing that had sent him a list of people that she had interviewed. Most of whom never talked to her, so Jerry's kind of ticked off about this. But Vic went through the list, and he wrote D for dead and F for frail. So my first job was to find all the Fs I could to interview,
sure,
and then work my way. And, you know, Frohnmeyer's clearly not on the frail list, because no. they kept it secret.
Yeah, right. You know, I was really stunned by that. He worked... And the same, I've got a kind of a part-time job for a little company that is housed in the same law office building in Eugene as Harang Long.
Mm-hmm.
And I walked out, well, I saw him at the old timers and had a really nice catch-up with him. I mean, really, and he was animated and really, really good. And then on Thursday, maybe the same Thursday you're talking about, I ran, or no, it was on Tuesday, I'm sorry, it was on a Tuesday I was down there. I ran into him in the hallway and, hi, how you doing? Great, and all this kind of stuff. Had another little catch up with him. The following, he died on a Monday, I think.
Yeah, it was like Monday.
Late Monday.
Yeah, I mean, it's like announced Tuesday morning or something.
Yes,
like that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I'm at work and the staff came in and he said, did you know Frohnmeyer just died? And I said, that can't be.
Yeah.
I said, check and make sure it's the day Frohnmeyer. And it was. And I was just blown away by it. And then Bill Gary was doing an interview and out in the hallway, and he finished, and we had a little commiseration together, and he said the fact that you didn't know would have made Dave very, very happy.
Yeah.
Because he had gone through that trauma with his family. He didn't want anybody else beleaguered by that. So, boy, I was just shocked.
Yeah, his brother at the big service they had at U of O, his brother was saying that... Dave went to sleep that night knowing that he was going to teach to the next morning.
Yeah.
So it was just, you know, his body just
wound. Just wound down, yeah.
Yeah.
He was an interesting guy. He would have been a good governor.
Yeah.
He would have been, well, for Vic's time, like we talked about, was perfect. I thought the time was perfect for Frohnmeyer. Not taking anything away from Barbara, but he would have been better suited for the job.
Yeah. Yeah,
to that ballot measure 5. He was perfect.
Yeah.
He was the right guy.
Yeah. Writing this biography is fascinating because I grew up in Southern Oregon.
Oh, okay.
In fact, Dave was my first girlfriend's babysitter. So I was just, there were so many things we had to talk about.
Wow, exactly.
But then I went off to college, and so when Vic is governor, I'm not living here. Mm-hmm. I'm in college, graduate school and stuff, and then I moved back in 1990. And so... The Frohnmeyer Roberts election is when I moved back.
Okay.
And just watching that, and it was stunning to me. It's like Frohnmeyer didn't really campaign very much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It was just like, you know, you have to work for this. And the demographics have shifted. This is becoming a Democratic state.
Mm-hmm.
what we'd see with the Clinton election in 92.
Sure.
That's, you got to work for this.
Right.
So it's just fascinating.
And then the other thing, the demagoguery hadn't really, was just starting to take root.
Yeah.
And that's what that got him, I think.
Yeah.
Because the,
yeah,
the right wing nuts.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
That's too bad. Yeah, usually, man, that was a big surprise.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I'm talking to people about the shift in the Republican Party. Vic describes it very well, especially after he left office. He, for instance, ran to be was a Republican National Committeeman because the other option was a right wing.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, we just can't have that. But he was just appalled that all these people would get elected into Central Committee positions and then redefine what it meant to be a Republican.
Yeah.
You know, his principles were just solid the whole time. And
It's
just an amazing change.
And remarkable change, yeah. It was just, I don't know. I remember, been about 8 or 9 years ago, I've got a friend of mine that is in Edinburgh. I go up and play golf with him every now and then. And because of Roger Martin, he's a tie-in, his name is Michael Hunter. Hell, you may even know him. I mean, he knows everybody, it seems like. And these guys came in, and there was an old-time legislator. Can't remember his name. Is at a steakhouse in Portland, that 72-ounce steakhouse. What was that guy's name? Anyway, he asked me. He says, "Dan," he says, "what the hell are we going to do to get back on track?" And I said, "Well, you gotta move a little closer to the center in Oregon, because look at the demographics, just like you say, and you can't be clear out there on the right because that's not where your constituents are."
Yeah.
And then that night, the guy that he was with cornered me, and he says, "We don't care.
Yeah.
We don't care. We've got our values, God damn it. We're not going to change." You asked me a question, I gave you an answer.
Yeah. When the Tea Party first popped up, which has been spectacularly unsuccessful on the West Coast, but I was on doing a call-in radio show with the person who said he was kind of the head of the Tea Party, and they adamantly were not going to run candidates.
Yep.
It's like, well, then you're adamantly not going to have any impact. No, we'll hold people's feet to the fire. Unless you've got people in office, you're not.
Yeah, exactly. No, it was a strong... And that's kind of where we started out the conversation.
Yeah.
You know, it's so different today.
Yeah.
You know, it's very tough. How did you get into the job you're in? You said you went away to college, but how do you get into teaching political science?
Well, actually, as an undergraduate, hated political science.
Hmm.
But then... I'm an internationalist,
okay.
And so when I was figuring out what I wanted to do and finally said, international is what I really, really liked, that's international relations is in political science.
Okay.
So I got a master's degree from a place called the Monterey Institute of International Studies, so I actually had to live 2 blocks from Pebble Beach.
Oh,
was horrible.
Right, in Monterey.
My wife and I go down every January, we go down and spend a 3 or 4 day weekend down there, and say, you know, we can go to places where you used to live if you want in January. No, this is fine. It's so nice to see flowers and, you know, that kind of stuff. And then I got my doctorate at Northwestern. And when I moved out here to teach, I taught at the University of Portland for 11 years.
Wow.
And my dad was a county commissioner. My grandparents, my grandfather... was one of the founders of the Extension Service in Oregon in the 1930s. So there's just all these, we knew these people. I wear bow ties. Why? Because John Dellenbach was a family friend.
Okay.
Right. You know, so, cool. You know, that kind of stuff. And it turned out, and it still is amazing to me, in academic political science, no one pays attention to actual politics. And so I just kind of got into it like that.
Cool.
So, you know, great. You guys can go to your conferences and publish articles that 6 people are going to read.
Sure.
There's other things that need to be done.
We're good. Well, it's been nice talking to you.
Yeah, this is great. This is good. You know, when Vic and I were talking about the book, the key thing is it's not necessarily about Vic. It's about the times and this guy who was in it. And you're giving some wonderful context.
Good. If any questions come up, call me.
Yeah.
But because I he deserves special recognition.
Yeah.
He really does.
Yeah. one of the fun things about politics, and I've been observing this now for about 10 years, and I finally was talking to Jerry about it in last time I talked to her, actually that fateful February day, said, you know, one of the reasons that this is now a Democratic state is because of Vic. Because all that new economy is bringing in people who are moderate, and here that means they're Democrats.
Yeah.
And so that's Washington County, his hometown, is clearly the poster child, but it's all anywhere where that new economy is.
Yeah.
It's Democrats.
Right.
And
I mean, imagine doing all that stuff.
Yeah.
And then dealing with the problem of state government at the same time.
Yeah.
And on and on and on. I mean, he was.
Yeah.
He deserves a special place.
Yeah. Remarkable.
For sure.
And, while Jerry was lying awake at night trying to figure out how to save the world, and oh my gosh, the Rajneeshis are doing this, the Taiwanese want this, she at one point said to Vic, how do you sleep at night? I said, I have my principles. I sleep like a baby.
Well, that was a key appointment.
Yeah.
Jerry is. She was perfect for the job.
Yeah.
Still is.
Yeah.
But, they were very, very strong allies.
Yeah.
Perfect allies.
Yeah. And she's a classic example of what you were talking about with he would pick good people.
Mm-hmm.
But often the people, like Jerry, still doesn't really know why she was picked. Because she was his first choice in 78.
Okay.
It wasn't Lynn Newbery, it was Jerry. And the only experience she had with him was being married to Al and being peripherally involved in the campaign.
Mm-hmm.
But Vic talks to people, and even his 1978 campaign manager, Carol Whitney, she was just going in to see if he had ideas and possibly a low-level position because she was interested in post-divorce moving into something.
Mm-hmm.
And he talked to her for an hour and a half and called her 2 days later and said, I want you to run this campaign.
Interesting.
Just amazing.
Mm. You know, you mentioned Lynn Newbery. My recollection of that is that he was part of the transition.
Yeah. He and Travis Cross were the transition guys.
Which is another example.
Yeah.
I mean, Newbery was, he was a remarkable Ways and Means chairman. He really was.
Mm-hmm.
I owe a lot to him. He taught me an awful lot.
Mm-hmm.
He was the perfect guy to bring in there.
Yeah.
He really was. I mean, there wasn't anybody else that knew budgets any better than he did.
Yeah.
And it was a time when you needed that knowledge.
Yeah.
Vic didn't have.
Yeah.
That intimate knowledge.
Yeah.
He had the overall. But I didn't. But the way you said that, I interpreted it to mean that he maybe was considering him as his chief of staff.
Yeah, his number two choice.
Really?
Yeah. But Lynn, family business and things.
I didn't know that. I just assumed that he was the transition leader.
No. We wanted him to be chief of staff.
Huh.
And then eventually you go down and get to Lee. I don't know how many were gone through, but Lee was not in the top five, say.
I can understand that.
It's fascinating talking to Jack Faust about that, because Faust was really close to Lee.
Mm-hmm.
Faust is the one who wrote Vic's first inaugural address.
Really?
Yeah. Which Vic says defines who Vic is. So it's just...
Interesting. History, you can always learn.
Yeah, it's fun. And it's fun doing this project because, just by the way, this is all archival quality, and it's eventually going to go into the Pacific Archives, where his archival stuff is. But doing this